Good morning. My name is Michael McCusker. Today's program is essentially about an earlier catastrophic Washington eruption than those we are currently being daily subjected to. And it took place in the other, far-left corner, Washington. It seems that the days of my radio show are spectacular anniversaries this rain-sponged, muddy month of May 2017. May 4th, the day four Kent State students were killed by the Ohio National Guard in 1970. Last Thursday, May 11th, was the day of discovery when Robert Gray claimed and named the Columbia River in 1792. And it was also Bloody Monday, 1970, when club-wielding Portland, Oregon SWAT cops attacked anti-Vietnam War students and Vietnam veterans who were protecting an ersatz hospital at Portland State University. And today is the 37th anniversary of the Titanic eruption of Mount St. Helens, in which nearly 60 persons were killed, and which today's program commemorates with fact and satire. We'll start with something I wrote, The Prettiest Mountain. The way popular history has of getting things confused, it will probably be common knowledge in future years that Harry Truman, who was once President of the United States, died in the spectacular explosion of Mount St. Helens on May 18, 1980. At least 60 persons died in that blast, which had the fury of several nuclear bombs and devastated 200 square miles. Thousands of animals were killed. Entire forests were obliterated. Spirit Lake disappeared. Mudslides and log jams flooded the Toutle River and knocked out several bridges. The Columbia River Channel had to be dredged because mud washed downriver blocked ships. Eastern Washington was covered with volcanic ash as far as Spokane, and pumice littered ocean beaches. Millions of tons of dust was hurled into the sky, and it was thought a ring of dirt and smoke would form around Earth and reduce sunlight. Mount St. Helens was the prettiest mountain in the Pacific Northwest. Its shape was almost a perfect cone like Japan's Mount Fuji and was usually wrapped in snow. The first eruption was in late March 1980, and there have been numerous others in the 37 years since the cataclysmic May 18th blast, though none have approached its intensity or destruction. Lately, the mountain has been quiet. No one is certain if it has shut off its fires or preparing for another blow. The last time Mount St. Helens had erupted was in 1857. The last volcanic eruption in the continental United States had been Mount Lassen, also in the Cascades, in 1914. Hawaii's Mauna Loa and Mauna Kea have been active for several years. 2 weeks before the first eruption in March, a series of earthquakes shook St. Helens as a prelude. Steam and ash soon began shooting out of the cone, sometimes as high as a mile. Huge boulders from deep within the mountain's core were thrown out over a large area. Residents and most of the loggers working around the mountain were evacuated. Harry Truman, owner of a popular lodge at Spirit Lake, refused to leave. Stubborn as a famous namesake, Truman said he had lived on the mountain for 50 years and that it was his life. Thousands flocked to see the volcano. For the first few days, airplane traffic around the mountain was so congested, the FAA stepped in to regulate flights, but not before a plane crash-landed with its occupants, luckily unharmed. Among the first volcanic memorabilia to appear for sale were T-shirts with the question, "Where were you when the mountain blew?" The shirts sold out within a few hours. The National Geologic Survey issued warning booklets to people in the area of the volcano. It contained information on what to do should the mountain erupt. The first instruction was, during an eruption, move away from a volcano, not toward it. Walt Curtis, Oregon's long-standing unofficial poet laureate, whose essay on the origin of the name Oregon I read on this program last week, grew up in Portland and regarded Mount St. Helens as a shrine and inspiration. He wrote in an article for the North Coast Times-Eagle in June 1982 that male TV newscasters spoke of a St. Helens volcano as being an unruly female and told a corny, sexist joke. Do you know why St. Helens erupted? She didn't take her earth control pills. Curtis said his 65-year-old mother responded, "They're so stupid. The volcano is really named after a male, an obscure British ambassador whose first name was Allen, spelled in an old-fashioned way," his mother said. "I must admit, I have always felt this gorgeous mountain possessed a feminine quality," Curtis wrote. "The Klickitat Indians also thought of the volcano as a woman. She was Luwit, the snow witch, consigned by the Great Spirit to reside in snow and ice. Uneasy magic has always been associated with St. Helens. Miners in the 1920s claimed they were attacked by a family of Bigfoots, hairy apes. These apocryphal creatures threw rocks and broke out the windows of their cabin. In March 1980, as the mountain began to crumble, spew ice, spew ash and soot, belch pumice and broken ice blocks, we never dreamed these minor eruptions would come to a cataclysmic conclusion. Mount St. Helens is only about 5,000 years old," Curtis wrote. "Northwest Indians have many legends about mountains, such as nearby Mount Hood and Mount Adams, battling with each other. The legendary Bridge of the Gods on the Columbia River may well have been created and collapsed by volcanic activity." Curtis wrote that scientists and reporters were dumbfounded when the first puffs of smoke and ash dirtied the snow in the spring of 1980. Geologists, reporters, and volcanists scoured and probed the mountain in helicopters and chartered planes. They implanted seismographs to gauge the pattern of minor earthquakes and harmonic tremors, attempting to predict the timing and severity of future eruptions. Was there any logic? Curtis wondered. After all, the last time this happened was in 1857. A red zone or danger area was set up and declared off limits. Loggers were unable to work in the area. Sightseers were stopped at roadblocks. Sheriffs and forest rangers tried to persuade Harry Truman to leave his lodge at Spirit Lake. Curtis wrote that the May 18th eruption occurred just as everyone was getting bored with inconsequential volcano coverage. "The top quarter of the mountain exploded, sending poisonous smoke 60,000 feet into the air," he wrote. "The intense heat of the explosion seared a 15-mile-wide arc around the mountain's north flank. Changed into a bubbling mass, Spirit Lake disappeared. Dead deer and elk were seen in many places. Some animals wandered about as if stunned. Months later, human bodies, dangling grotesquely, would be found blown into trees or buried beneath gray ash. Stalled cars had melted windshields. One contained human remains, resembling a 10-pound roast." Curtis compared the nuclear bomb-sized eruption of Mount St. Helens with the probability of nuclear warfare before the 20th century ended. He wrote, "I truly believe the destruction of this particular mountain at this time in world history is a prophetic warning. Nation states must begin to dismantle nuclear arsenals, or we shall have a thermonuclear holocaust, Armageddon, if you will, in the next 25 to 50 years. Thousands of St. Helens-like eruptions will happen if we don't make a concerted and conscientious effort to bring about nuclear disarmament." Curtis wrote that every time he looked toward the north, enjoying the spectacular scenery of the snow-capped peaks of the Cascades, known as the Ring of Fire, "I see one lone decapitated natural shrine. Observing the serene and beautiful sentinel leveled by a cosmic bulldozer, my thoughts become gloomy." Harry Truman, who was not president, but was a drinking companion of Supreme Court Justice William O. Douglas, became an authentic folk hero for his refusal to leave the mountain that had been his home for half a century as proprietor of the popular Spirit Lake Lodge. He might not have thought he would actually die, but that is incidental to legend. He will be most likely remembered as eternally linked with Mount St. Helens as the man who exploded with the mountain. and Now by Michael Graham, The Great Onion Peak Eruption. Geologists were dealt yet another baffling surprise when historically dormant Onion Peak on the Oregon coast near Arch Cape erupted in a peculiar superating blast of blue gas and steam, sending kitchen-like odors into the already gingery atmosphere created from nearby Mount St. Helens. Local civil defense stations were flooded with calls complaining about the pungent fumes. No one was injured in the eruption, although almost everyone in the area later reported sudden, stinging tears in their eyes immediately after the blast. Some residents who were outside at the time complained they were hit by moist, stringy debris that resembled sauerkraut and soiled their clothes. The closest person to the volcano when it erupted was a botanist named Gunther Leake, who had been camped at the base of Onion Peak. He reported a strange, rotting vegetable-like odor moments before the peak blew. Leake said he started running down the mountain. He met up almost immediately with the 2.5 members of the quickly responding Arch Cape Volunteer Fire Department, who were running up the slope with a frayed hose. Just then, a thick, creamy substance began to flow from the crater. The botanist and the fireman ran for their lives as the ooze rapidly covered everything in its path. "I felt like we were being chased by a salad dressing," Leake said later. Because the fumes from Onion Peak produced uncontrollable watering of the eyes, tearful members of the local police reserve cordoned off the road to the mountain, preventing anyone without an official need-to-know security clearance from venturing closer. The National Guard arrived and put the mountain under martial law. The Red Cross attempted to evacuate residents to Castle Rock, just offshore, and to the former lighthouse on Tillamook Rock, which currently serves as a columbarium for the cremated, charging a boat fee to whomever they could coax aboard their emergency fleet of surplus Air Force rubber dinghies. Most residents refused to flee. "This is my home," said one in tears. "I can't leave it like this," he said, pointing to a house almost buried under the stringy sauerkraut substance, topped with a thick, creamy lava, which had the color and texture of Thousand Island dressing, sprinkled lightly with an ash, sort of like Pepper's Three. An army of reporters, photographers, and television crews were flown into the area by a squadron of traffic watch helicopters and interviewed everybody. Among the first was Gunther Leake, the plucky botanist who raced a volcano, as the headlines and TV anchors described it. "The mountain started peeling away in front of my eyes," he told reporters. "I can't explain why, but I just started crying." Leake was given a final look at ravaged Onion Peak before returning to botanical obscurity. The bulbous peak had been sliced away. In its place were ice-stinging geysers and a peppery ash. The flowers and trees were gone, buried underneath layers of thick, creamy lava. "Most of the mountain lay in the valley, like onions on a hamburger bun," Leake remarked. An ad hoc meeting by several residents produced a statement calling upon the government to declare Arch Cape a disaster area. Though there seemed to be no serious damage or threat to the small tourist community, it seemed to some a heaven-sent opportunity to make up for the sagging tourist season, which locals claimed was a result of complaints about sour odors prior to the eruption. One suggestion discussed during the meeting was to invite prominent officials to visit Onion Peak and push them into the superating crater as a form of appeasement. Oregon Governor Victor Atiyah said off the record at a press conference after touring the devastated area, which he said looked and smelled like a huge salad, that he had the queerest sensation of being eyed speculatively by some Arch Cape residents, like a roast they planned for dinner, he said. So far, there has been only the single eruption from Onion Peak. Geologists warn that the danger might not be over, but they say that harmonic tremors within the mountain, which one likened to the rumbling of an upset stomach, have quieted. Geologists are baffled about the eruption of Onion Peak. A major reason for their surprise is that Onion Peak is not hollow like a normal volcano. Since the eruption, residents claim that sometimes when the wind tilts from the east, blowing off Onion Peak, they smell something spoiling. And that was The Great Onion Peak Eruption by Michael Graham, who is a writer and former fire marshal of the Cannon Beach Arch Cape, Oregon Volunteer Fire Department. He wrote this for the North Coast Times Eagle on July 18, 1980, exactly 2 months after the massive Mount St. Helens eruption. And now, an abrupt change of eruption. In Reason We Trust, or Do We? By Dr. Robert Brake. The increasingly democratic dissemination of information via the internet, social media, Wikipedia, and the transformation of the news industry into a 24-hour entertainment machine has not produced an educated public. It has created an army of ill-informed, angry citizens who denounce intellectual achievement and distrust experts. Many Americans are indifferent to real journalism, addicted to hoaxes that are harder to kill than a slasher flick monster, and eager to hurl the word expert as a nasty epithet. Yes, we are living in a post-fact age. To disagree is to disrespect. To correct another is an insult. Add to refuse to acknowledge all views as worthy of consideration, no matter how fantastic or inane they are, is to be closed-minded. We Americans face a big problem, some people thinking they are bright when in fact they are not very bright at all. That phenomenon is called the Dunning-Kruger effect, named after research psychologists at Cornell University who identified it in a landmark 1999 study. The Dunning-Kruger effect, in sum, means that the dumber you are, the more confident you are that you are not actually dumb. Enter President Donald Trump, who unleashed his attack on experts in early 2016. In the early debates, the short-fingered vulgarian had often been caught at a loss for words over basic issues of public policy, and now he was striking back. On April 4th last year, Trump told a crowd, "They say, oh, Trump doesn't have experts. You know, I've wanted to say this. The experts are terrible. They say, Donald Trump needs a foreign policy advisor. But supposing I didn't have one, would it be worse than what we're doing now?" Trump's sneering at experts tapped into a long-standing American belief that experts and intellectuals are not only ruining the lives of ordinary people, but are doing a lousy job of it. Trump's ascendancy in 2016 was a result of many factors, including a crowded field that produced a plurality winner. But this eventual victory was undeniably one of the loudest trumpets sounding the impending death of expertise. Consider some of the ways in which Trump's campaign represented a one-man jihad against established knowledge. He was one of the original birthers who demanded Barack Obama prove his American citizenship. He quoted the National Enquirer approvingly as a source of news. He sided with anti-vaccine activism. He admitted that he got most of his information on foreign policy from the shows on Sunday morning television. He suggested that Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia, who died from natural causes in early 2016, might have been murdered. And he charged that the father of one of his opponents, Ted Cruz, was involved in the mother of all conspiracy theories, the assassination of John F. Kennedy. And that is just a partial list of Trump's displays of willful, persistent ignorance. Rather than shamed by his lack of knowledge, he exulted in it. Nevertheless, Trump survived, seized the Republican nomination, and won, because in the end, he connected with a particular kind of voter who believes that knowing about things like nuclear deterrence is just so much pointy-headed claptrap. Sadly, voters not only did not care that Trump was ignorant or wrong, they likely were unable to recognize his ignorance or errors. Dunning and Kruger nailed it when they established that uninformed or incompetent people are unlikely to recognize their own lack of knowledge or incompetence. Trump's confident missteps were more the products of his alleged narcissism and egotism. The voters' inability or unwillingness to see Trump's mistakes for what they were allowed his narcissism and egotism to expand unchecked. So Trump's strongest support in 2016, not surprisingly, was concentrated among people with low levels of education. "I love the poorly educated," Trump exulted after winning the February 24th Nevada caucuses, and that love was clearly reciprocated. Those Americans who believe that shadowy forces are ruining their lives and that any visible intellectual ability is itself a suspicious characteristic in a national leader found a champion in Donald Trump. Nonetheless, there are many of us who champion facts, knowledge, and expertise. We deal with a lot of tough things in life, and we deal with grief and various addictions in stages. The same is true when Donald Trump makes his patent inflammatory, fantastical, or threatening remarks. After making one of those remarks, pick one, on just about any day he tweets, the bilious billionaire, his aides, and his Republican Party sycophants run through a series of spin-doctoring steps in a Houdini-like effort to escape the steamer trunk into which he has locked himself. At the end of the process, most fair-minded observers conclude that Trump never really escapes and that he will eventually run out of oxygen somewhere in the deep waters off the coast of American politics. But not Trump. With his powers of self-delusion far beyond those of us mere mortals and strategy from his own art of the deal, Trump views his utterances as merely the opening bid in a never-ending negotiation over meaning. And like Humpty Dumpty in Through the Looking Glass, meaning is what Trump says it is, or isn't, or may be, or what you want to hear, or don't want to hear. You think that Trump's attack on expertise and his obsession with destroying the meaning of meaning could not work. After all, we Americans are clear-eyed, sensible people, right? Surely they see his rhetoric for what it is, a verbal three-card Monty game in hell. I am not so sure about that. But I will side with the experts who, though they do make mistakes, at least understand that average citizens are rarely on an equal intellectual footing with diplomats and doctors. And real experts refute the ridiculous notion that all voices, even the most insensible, should be treated with equal seriousness. Let's side with the experts. It's okay to be an elitist, despite the angry anti-intellectual crowd's dismal dismissal of them as undemocratic. The only bumper sticker on my old car now reads, "In Reason We Trust." And that was "In Reason We Trust, or Do We?" by Dr. Robert Brake, who is an Ocean Beach, Washington freelance writer and thinker and contributes quite often to this program. And I would like to end this program with a poem by Robert Legge, "Someday in May." Deep in the shadows we linger, intrepid malingering, waiting and watching for the sun to appear, now just a smear. Whoever dares to venture out must allow a few minutes to break free from clouded thoughts and restless dreamy haunts far down where we hide. The sidewalks are cold outside and dreary from the night's misty dust. Our morning reeling is somehow unbearable, and to face another day pushes the crises our way. Suddenly the sun stands up and stretches, filling up the far corners of the valley, reaching for the most intimate shadows. Treacherous mountains of leering darkness slip away for the day and rest. The burglar who uses dark for his flashlight is secretly upset by the change and lightly repulsed by the creaking hinge as the back door opens to invite the newness in for breakfast. Now he must readjust for another day, a simple portion of the month of May, where the millions of stars fade into bars and chrome-distorted people start their fancy motor cars. And this has been Michael McCusker.